My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. First off, I'd like to thank the group for once again inviting me out and giving me a wonderful welcome. As soon as I hit the door, you know, I see a lot of familiar faces when I come back here. And, you know, it's new friends. Be alcoholic like me, it's a good thing to come where you're welcome. It's a good thing to come where people are glad to see you coming. It's a good thing to come where people are giving you handshakes and giving you hugs. If you're not used to getting that, keep coming back. If you're used to getting put out of places, keep coming back up in here. You know, you'll be able to reap those benefits too. You know, I was impressed with the number of new friends we had stand up tonight. And I want to welcome you to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the most important thing I can do this evening. And that's probably what I'm going to do tonight. You know, I don't know where we're going, but, you know, I think I want to talk to our new friends. You know, I want to thank Louie for giving it up. Where's Louie? For 10 minutes. I want to thank Louie doubly. I want to thank Louie and Ryan for coming and picking me up and bringing me over here. And I want to thank Louie for giving up that message, the 10-minute message, and starting this party off right, wherever you are, Louie. New friends, I didn't always look like this. Didn't always dress like this. Didn't always smell like this. Didn't always think like this. Didn't always act like this. Been on this road a couple of days. Know a lot of people in this room, some people I'm very impressed with. The specific group is a group that really represents Alcoholics Anonymous and all that it stands for. So when I get in a group like this, around people like this, and being the kind of guy I am, image, all front, no back, wanting to impress, that's who I am. You know, my temptation is to get in front of you and talk about, I'm not gonna share a long drunkalogue, I just wanna share about recovery. But I remember being new to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember a speaker standing up in front of the group, you know, somewhat like I'm standing up in front of the group tonight, dressed pretty nice, hair comb, eyes bright, stringing sentences together real well. And I remember thinking to myself that night, I know this cat ain't been where I've been, I know he ain't felt what I felt, I know he ain't done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? So it's very important that I let you know that the man that's standing in front of you right now is not the same one that stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous October the 11th, 1986. I'm going to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today in the hopes that somebody sitting out there will be thinking like I was thinking. I used to do the same thing. Man, I used to feel the same way. Or more important, I too want to have this thing. Quick bio, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and I come from a real large family. I'm one of six boys. We stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room. Six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. Earliest memory of my old man was he was alcoholic, and I didn't want to be like him. Now, my father wasn't violent, and my father wasn't abusive. My father was an absentee drunk, and every other Friday, like clockwork, you knew he wouldn't show up with the check. Be a kid in the neighborhood who would feel like it was his duty to tell my family how my old man had been performing up at the pool hall the previous Friday or Saturday night, and I feel ashamed and embarrassed, and those are feelings I'm familiar with from an early age. Pops got put out when I was 9 or 10 years old. Moms proceeded to raise these six boys by herself. Don't know about the rest of you guys. I always had, you know, when I was growing up, I don't know about dysfunctional family. And check this out before we go any further with this. You know, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I come from a broken home. I come from a large family, and we didn't have a lot. I really didn't notice it. You know, first car in my family was the car I bought when I graduated from high school. We used to go next door to use the neighbor's telephone to make calls. I wouldn't have changed the way I grew up for anything in the world. So don't get that part confused, you know. I have a mom, and you'll hear me talk about my mom, and the reason you hear me talk about my mom so much, she's a big part of my story. And as I get in my story, I achieved and I accomplished some things, all of them, most of them I owe to my mom. Not out of any virtue on my part, because I was scared of her. You know, my mama didn't play, you know. And, you know, she raised these six boys by herself. And when I was a kid, you know, ideal family life. I didn't know what an ideal family was. Maybe you don't today, anybody that's new. But ideal families, when I was growing up, I took them from TV programs. And the TV programs that came on that showed ideal families when I was growing up, Father Knows Best, Ozzie and Harriet, My Three Sons, Leave It to Beaver, Donna Reed, and you know, Beth, that wasn't jumping off in my house. You know, when you grown, you get something that's called perspective, and perspective works like this. You got a mom that raised six boys by herself. She didn't have a high school education, and she was on welfare. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk, and when you grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old and you bring a couple of partners home from school on a Wednesday afternoon and you hit the front door and mom's in the living room with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed. If your name is Ralph, you start living in that fantasy world I lived in much of my life about what life is really like for me. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in that prison I've lived in much of my life. Prison I live in sometimes today, and that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion around. I'll whine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. We got a little, you know, we got a little activity, you know, we got a little activity going on in the middle. So, you know, and I need to talk to some people right now because somebody's confused thinking this guy is making eye contact with everybody. He might be a pretty good speaker. Don't let that fool you. I'm looking for the people whose attention is drifting, look like you getting restless. I'm going to work on your ass. You'll like me before this is over with, right? Trapped in what I think you think about me. New friends, you know. There are lots of common themes you'll hear from our members when they get up to this podium. And one of the common themes you'll hear from most of our members is they never felt like they fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I accomplished some things growing up. Every one of you had me in your school. I was generally class president or student body president. I was a straight-A student, teacher's pet, played ball, made all-stars. On the outside, it seemed like I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really know me, you won't like me. Because I was smart and I was teacher's pet and I was straight-A student, would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. If I only could have been cool, man. Because in my neighborhood, it was a whole lot more currency placed on cool than smart. Because the cats who was cool, you know, they were the ones in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters, and they knew how to talk to girls, and girls were a mystery to me. So I'm growing up at a turbulent time in this country, and it was an interesting time. It was the 60s, and a lot of stuff was going on, and I was caught up in it, man. You know, I was really community active, and I was really, you know, I'm politically active, and I'm on a fast track for success, and I'm really out to prove I'm not going to be like my daddy. I never make my family ashamed of me. Whenever I get a family, my kids will be proud of me. So I'm growing up like that, right? So now I'm 16 years old. I'm still shy. I'm still introverted. Have not touched a drop of nothing, right? 16, I get a girlfriend. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for the rest of you guys. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes that went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a suitable amount of time to pass, told my other boy, look, I want to go with her. He went and asked her, came back and told me, she said yes. Now I got a girlfriend, right? Don't know what to do with girls. Ralph don't do girls. Now, I had had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend, right? Check this out. This is me. This give you just this little example will tell you about me. This is my official girlfriend. If you would ask her who do you go with, she would have said Ralph. On my official girlfriend, I used to call her. You know them old rotary phones? I'd call and that seventh number would come around and it would seem like it'd come back in slow motion and that terror would set in. Because I knew what would have to happen when she answered the phone, right? It's the telephone. You got to talk, right? I just hang up on her. Click on my official girlfriend over and over. I didn't have no conversation, right? This particular night, I go out on a double date. day. Me and my girl in the back seat, older partner of mine in the front seat with his girl. Plastic cup of rum and coke came to the back seat this particular night. Drank that rum and coke down, went down real warm, rushed back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hand started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said. I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me in a lot of places. It starts talking about me in the front. There's a chapter in the front of our book, New Friends, called The Doctor's Opinion. And they dropped a line in there that I recognized the first time I saw it. There's a line in The Doctor's Opinion that goes, men and women like me drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And I understood it first time I saw it. Some of you old veterans out there might have been drinking that scotch and been like, ah, I'd be like, ooh, but I like what it did when it went down. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand we talk about this disease being progressive in nature because that's how it showed up in my experience. That first night I drank, I didn't get drunk, didn't get pissy drunk, didn't do nothing crazy. Kissed on my girl, kissed on her some places I'd never kissed before. Got a warm, tipsy feeling, liked it. That's how my drinking stayed for a time. I would drink to go out on the weekends and the party. Graduated from high school in 71, graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I'm still drinking to go to parties on the weekend. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only to go to the parties on the weekend, but now it's crept up to during the day to get ready for the party. By 72, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but after class during the week. By the end of 72, I'm drinking not only during the week, but now I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By 73, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing other drugs, I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about it at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the true from the false. And the way that worked for me was this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money, didn't chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over my house and I didn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? You know, didn't have nothing to discuss. I don't know. You know, I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. Check this out. No offense, new young friends. I'm not talking about new friends, young friends, but I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up in. See, I come from an era of sex, drugs, rock and roll. I come from a time when you would go to a concert, you didn't even have to know your neighbor, you just passing shit. You know, I come from a time that I don't know if it was a simpler time because a lot of stuff was going on, but in some ways it seemed like a simpler time. In 2007, you got to worry about sexually transmitted diseases, safe sex, AIDS. Man, back in those days, I'd go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next, I don't need to know your sign, your name, what job you have. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Do you do it the way that I do it? Man, and that's just the way that I was rolling, you know. And a lot of people, I hear a lot of our members get up to the podium and they get to sharing. And you guys are just a lot deeper than I am. You can go back in your history and talk about when I was drinking and feel the hole in my gut. When I was drinking, it seemed like it. You know what? Anybody in here, you coming up in the late 60s and the early 70s, and you ain't gonna be no square. That's just the way you roll. That's just what you did. I'm at this major university, man. That's just what we did. I can't give you no, I didn't give it no deep thought. Pass it. Okay, you know, that's how I'm rolling, man. So I'm doing this deal. Somehow I make it through school. I graduate from school in 76, and I start working as a counselor for LA City Schools. I should have had the thing normal people acquire. I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when I was working. I buy a car, and then I make exactly 3 car payments. Then come find it. Come find it. First time I got a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call LAPD. I'm 9 months behind on the car note, right? And I'm calling. My car is missing. They do whatever they do. Get back on the phone. No, Mr. Wright, your car ain't stolen. The rightful owner just came and got this. You know, next 2 times I didn't even trip, right? I already knew. Kind of brother that never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. 0. No problem balancing my bank book. I stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. A couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking back in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. One fact stands out real clear to me about those days when I thought it was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. Sit, that's all. That's how I did it, man. get paid and I party. And I'm broke. You know, can't tell you the day or the hour, the time, the moment, where I was, what I was doing, when alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me and became a necessity. Bill's description of the invisible, I can't tell you that it did happen. I'm one of them people that come in the rooms, Alcoholics Anonymous. I play the regret game. I'm one of them people that sit in the rooms and be thinking, you know, I see somebody. I could remember looking at people like Bob. If I ever get like that, I quit. You know, I'd be looking at you. Look. Man, you look like you need some help, you know. You know, the book talks about seeking the Lord Companion. It wasn't long before I became the Lord Companion. But I sit in the rooms of Alcoholics and I play that regret game, the game that goes somewhat like, if I only knew then what I knew now, I never would have took that year right. You know, it reminds me of a story I tell about a boy named Johnny. Johnny used to like to play with himself, and his father used to warn him against that. Johnny, you know, his father goes off to work, comes home early one day. Little Johnny's bedroom door is closed. Father goes in the door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father looks at him, said, "Son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind." Little Johnny stops and looks up at his daddy and said, "Well, daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses?" You know, and that story reminds me of me and the life. See you going down, I'm just gonna do, you know. And we don't have enough time for me to tell you all the things that should have been signs along the way that I might have had a problem. You know, and the cool thing about it, I love, you know, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about me all throughout that book. And I couldn't see it the first times. I came around here four times before I came to say. And the first times I came around, I couldn't see myself in the book at all, man. Couldn't see it at all. I would read Bill's story. All I saw was differences. I read Bill's story. Bill is an older white guy. We don't have that in common. You know, Bill was a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam era draft dodger. You know, Bill talked about in his story there had been no real infidelity. Well, in my story, he had missed me on that one. You know, Bill was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. You know, we don't have that in common. So I never saw the similarities between me and Bill and any of you guys when I came around. And this last time I came, somebody taught me how to read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, "Ralph, the same way that you read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the same way that you listen to our members share when they get up to the podium. The same way that you read, when you read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and when you listen to our members share their stories, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt, or did I do what he did?" And when I asked myself those questions, Bill's story became my story. I remember Bill in his story talking about the drive for success was on. I'd prove to the world I was important. I was at this major university. That was me. I proved to the world I was important. When I was a kid, I used to tell people, "I'm going to be the first black president of the United States." And they pat me on the head because I was a high achiever and say, "You go for it." Bill said in his story, he imagined himself the head of vast enterprises. I recognized that kind of grandiosity, me and Bill. Just like that. You know, so when I came back, I started seeing myself, you know, all the way. And in that chapter, you know, and when we talk about the third step, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but it talks about the alcoholic being very much an actor, leading a double life. And that was me in the workforce, you know, because parallel with my drinking, I was being successful working. So I ended up getting promoted on these jobs, and I ended up working in management at this major utility company in their law department. And I had a lot of people working out there like this, and I had a big glass window in front of me, which supposedly let me look out on the workforce. Well, it also allowed the workforce to look in on me. And when you be on one of them 4 or 5 day runs and you coming back and you get that whiplash thing going and you look to see if everybody's looking and everybody's looking, oh man, it was days I wanted to just go through the floor. And I don't have enough time to tell you, man, all the things that happened. I got married on a Saturday afternoon in April in 1980. And I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. Now, none of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. And all of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor party till 7:30 in the morning, right? Me and my brothers. They pour me in the bed at 7:30 and they get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm toe up. You know, I just lay on the bed, right? Some of y'all know, you know, I go to meetings all these many years later for lots of reasons, man. And one of the main reasons I still go to meetings is I can talk shorthand. You know, I can talk shorthand at a meeting. I ain't got to go into no long description. I can just say I'm toe up and somebody will nod their head. Yeah, you know that throwing the stomach lining up head like this. You know, I lay on the bed right there. Get me up at 10 for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding. And I wobble in, and my then wife-to-be is standing next to the preacher, and she look at me wobbling, she look at me, and she look at the preacher. She said, okay, scratch the own vial, set a regular on his ass, right? So now my lines are cut to two words. And we get into the ceremony, and it gets to my part, and I get ready to say, I threw up all over. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. To our new friends, if you're anything like me, when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, although I recognized most of the words they were saying in the meetings, the way that they use them in these rooms is not the way I use them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. I needed some help with some of them. They were talking about a psychic change, a phenomenon of craving, and an allergy of the body. And some of these old timers around here had to help me with that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I live pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over and over again. Because I got to let you know that wedding day was the high point of that marriage. Went downhill after that. Because I'm the kind of father and I'm that kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch. Wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up, going to the dining room table. Picking her purse up off the table, clutching it real close to her. She went back to the bathroom. I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home, sticking my key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter sitting right here and they crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, don't know about you, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already gives you the answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide, and it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, my house got broke into several times. Each time I pretended to call LAPD, each time I knew I was playing a game with myself. Because they had told me, you're going to give us our money or we're going to come up in there and get it. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember sitting on my back porch. Two-year-old daughter coming outside pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little shitty grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's gonna put some dollar bills in here for this change. I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter, and I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. I've already shared with you guys that my disease is progressive in nature, and that my experience is progressive in a couple of areas. Share one already. Takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily than I used to be willing to do to chase this thing. First time I went in my wife's purse, if you had strapped me up to a polygraph, I tell you I would have passed when I told you I'm not stealing this money. Because when I took that $40, I meant it when I said to myself, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. Meant it. Took the 40, went out, spent it up, came back home a little later, looked for some more money. She had moved the purse. I couldn't believe I had hit the purse like that, so I didn't look too hard for it. I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, though, it started writing on it in the mid-30s. Published in 1939, had it ready for a guy like me who stumbled along some years later. Describes me in lots of places. Perfect description of me is somewhere in that book they talk about, we don't know why, alcoholic will be unable to recall with sufficient force. Pain, suffering, humiliation weeks, even days ago. Replace that money before she knows it's missing. A couple of weeks later, same scenario presented. Out doing what I do, come home looking for some money. A couple of curious things happened this time. I didn't deliberate so long before I went in the purse. And that thought of replacing the money was replaced with a new thought. I said, last time I took $40, came back looking for some more money, and she had moved the purse. This time I'll take all the money out of the purse, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. And I was off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular basis. She started sleeping with it up under the pillow. That wasn't enough for a guy like me. Something about being out and coming in with that feeling on, you knowing the money's just an arm's length away. And I'd be laying in the bed, and she'd be laying in the bed with it under the pillow. And I'd let that real regular breathing set in, and I'd let it set in a minute. And I'd crawl out my side, crawl on her side, come up under the pillow, and I'd come out real slow, creep out the bedroom, creep out the front door, jump in my car, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. Wednesday, I might come back Monday. Did that one too many Wednesdays, came back one Monday. A note is on my door, the rest of your shit is at your mama's house. Suitcase on the porch, I'm put out my house, I'm now my daddy. I went to stay over at my mom's house. And over the course of that next year, my five brothers got put out of their respective homes. And we all ended up at my mom's house, and we damn near killed her. At this time, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. And she used to bring my daughter over to my mom's house on Saturday afternoons so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand and my big hand and take her to the store, just buy her ice cream. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read her story. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get since I've been here. They look like, this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like, I'm going to the store to buy Rain ice cream. Saturday afternoon, I disappeared. I sneaked back on Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. And on some of them long Sunday nights, man, I'd be sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, tears flowing. I could remember, man, them two heads sitting in the car and the headlights backing out, and through the tears, I'm thinking to myself, there go my life backing out this driveway. Heard a lot of people share they were scared of dying out there. That's not a part of my story. I really wasn't scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Sunday, the same as Tuesday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October 11, 1986, I got miserable enough and I got tired enough that I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. And I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. And on October the 13th, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I went to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was full of remorse and I was full of guilt and I was full of, I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done and what I had become. Only share with you guys the tip of the iceberg. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, start stealing out my mom's purse. Didn't share with you guys when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house. Check came to one of my little brothers in the name of R. White. All of us are R. White. Took that. Didn't share with you when my grandmother gave me $200 to buy her plane ticket to the family reunion. If it wasn't for my mom, my grandmother never would have saw Atlanta, Georgia. Didn't share with you the first time I tried to get sober. My ex-wife got me a job at her job. Stole $1,600 from them. Ruined her reputation in that industry. Didn't share with you a lot. Suffice it to say, I had a lot on my tip when I came. And I was full, I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I'd done, what I had become. And a speaker was standing up in front of the room, somewhat like I am tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the family, and he was sharing about taking from the job. And I remember sitting out there and looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that shit. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room and was reading my mail. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And he caught my attention. And he went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope at the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to. He described to me what I suffer from. And I was sitting at that meeting, and it was my fourth program of recovery, and I was 33 years old. And they have a saying about listening like only the dying can. And when that gentleman was speaking that night, I was taking everything he said personal. It was almost like he was saying, Ralph, don't take my word for it. He said it's something physically different about me than other folk. And seemed like he was talking directly to me. Don't take my word for it. I don't know about you. You know, I'm not here to convince anybody to stop drinking. Old timers in my home group say, we want you when alcohol is through with you. And I came back sweetly reasonable, and alcohol had its way with me. And I learned some anatomical things that happened with Ralph. Don't know about nobody else. When that ass is raw, my ears open and my mouth closes. But let it start healing up. All of a sudden, my mouth starts opening and my ears start closing. That had been my experience all the time. I guess I was tenderized enough this time that my ears were wide open and my mouth was closed shut. And I was sitting in the front and the guy got to sharing. And he started sharing in a way I had never heard. A lot of people had been talking at me in those last years. Boy, it seemed like for that little girl, you got that pretty little girl. Seemed like you straighten up. Look at this wife that you got. Seemed like you do better. My wife will be, man, if you can't come around here no better than that, don't come around here at all. A lot of people have been talking at me, but this cat was talking to me in a way I had never heard. He was talking to me, talking about himself. Had never seen anything like it. He was talking about this phenomenon of craving that sets me apart from other folk. Don't nobody else have it in them. Don't nobody, and he said, Ralph, ask yourself, how many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop off over here at my boy's house for a minute? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop off at happy hour this night? What happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks from 1979 to 1985, whole paycheck. Whole paycheck. My experience, not yours, not my sponsors, not Bill Wilson's, not Dr. Bob's, not nobody. My experience abundantly confirms to me when I take one anything, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay, smart guy, how do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday, second part of this disease. The mental, the obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion. I just got cold obsession to have for a guy like me. Where's that coming from? Control it, enjoy. Check this out. Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. Anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I stuck on that idea? I can't drink because of my body. I can't stop because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 cause of the soul sickness. And it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental, and the physical are straight. Now, that's what we do in these rooms, new friends. I'm not talking religious. Don't get scared. I know you. I know, because that's me. Y'all can't fool me. I know you're talking about the G word. You know, I know what you're talking about. You can't slip that one by on me. But if you come in here in the condition I came up in here in there, don't worry about it. I came up in here not knowing somebody might be up in here for their 16th time. Somebody might be for their fourth time like me. I came in talking crazy to people. What is sobriety going to do? Can you guarantee me I'm going to get sober? And you know what? This last time when I came, and that's the cold thing. When I was new, I used to think all you guys who have been doing this, oh, you do it because you like doing this. I didn't come in here marching toward the light. I came in here running from the fire. And if that's the way you up in here, that's a good way to be. I came up in here. I didn't know what recovery had in store for me, but I knew what drinking and using had in store for me. I was done. I was done. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's going to try to scare you into recovery. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's going to tell you if you go back out there still kicking it. You know, you can't scare an alcoholic like me. I told you I'm a strange alcoholic who did a lot of things. And then what I used to think of as my heyday, people used to see I was doing the way I was doing it. They'd look at me and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdosing? I'd be like, scared of overdosing? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more. You know, see? So you can't scare Alcoholic in My Variety. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about a message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. And the message tonight's speaker brings to you that's got the most depth and the most weight is that you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not know where his family was living and did not know what school this little girl was enrolled in. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake-up call to go to work in so long, I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy, man, who had graduated from a major university in this country, and my job at the end of my drinking was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage. I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And, you know, and the men and I stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that October in 1986. And the men and women in this fellowship loved me and nursed me back to health, gave me something that I wasn't looking for when I came up in these rooms, said something I found real strange, and I did not believe it, couldn't believe it. Last 4 years of my drinking, I never looked at myself full face in a mirror. I couldn't believe what I had become, and I couldn't believe I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what I was doing and how I was living, man. I wasn't raised like that. And I came up in here, and you guys said something I found real curious. New friends, you'll hear it too. They said, let us love you till you can love yourself. I didn't believe that one. How? I stink. If you turn your back on me, I'm liable to go up in your purse. How you gonna tell me you'll love something like me? That was before I knew what happens in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was before I knew what takes place in the, you know, when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we specialize in loving unlovable people. And you love me, and you nurse me back to health. And I got my feet set on a path to really go somewhere. You know, and I want to talk to our new friends about how it was this journey that I took that started October 11th in 1986. I started doing some things because my self-esteem was all the way down here. You know, at the end for me, I'm one of the ones that come all the way from my, you know, I'm one of the ones, my story goes like this. I had a lot and I had achieved a lot. I had gone pretty high in my chosen field and I had had a career that was real promising and I had made my mama proud of me and my family proud of me. I was the first kid from my neighborhood and first kid off the block to go to college. You know, I had achieved a lot of successes. But if you drink like I drink, old timers, yell to jail, Park Avenue, or the park bench. This disease that I suffer from is equal opportunity ass kicker. Don't care. And it did what it do. And it took me. And guys like me don't get a second chance. We don't get a second chance. And so at 33 years old, I knew life was over for me. It had been a long time since I had been welcome in anybody's house. I had turned into one of them next year daddies, the kind that on birthdays and Christmas, you kind of look at a watch, or if you like me, you look at the sun, and you think to yourself, I know about now they opening presents. Next year I'm gonna get that girl something. And slowly but surely you descend into that place that I descended into. Shrinks and sociologists, they do a lot of talking about the human condition. They talk about what's important for a person to live and to make it in the world. They'll say companionship, they'll say love, nurturing, a lot of things. My experience, it's a cold place to be, man, when you're living with no hope. I come from that dark place. I come from a real dark place, walking the streets with every day the same. A place of no hope. And I came in these rooms and I got something. My sponsors called them self-esteem building tasks. Small, achievable tasks. I made it through the Harbor Light program and I got a home group. I got two home groups. My first home group was a group called 9604 South Figueroa at night, in the old Crenshaw Alano Club in the daytime. And I started going to those meetings. I asked a counselor at my aftercare program, how long do I have to go to meetings? He said, you have to go to meetings till you want to go to meetings. I haven't had to go to meetings in a long, long, long time. Meetings became the highlight of my day. I didn't get a job for 18 months. I go to a 7 o'clock meeting, I go to a 12 noon meeting, I go to a 5 o'clock meeting, I go to a 7:30 or 8:30 meeting. Couldn't wait to catch the bus to the meeting. One night I went to a meeting. Didn't have a sponsor yet. I was about 4 months sober. You guys were talking this sponsor deal. And I was sitting at a speaker meeting, and a speaker was standing up like I'm standing up in front of the group tonight. And he was a guy I had been watching for a long time. You know, kind of guy like Bob Darrell. I'm new, and I see him, and I see everybody knows him. And he gets to the podium, and I love what he shared. You know, he'd do something like this. My sponsor was, you know, Bob Hunt. He'd do something like this. He said, listen. And the room would be quiet like this. He'd say, that's God. Two or more of us are gathered. Anyway, this particular night, this guy was standing up and he was sharing. And it was a speaker meeting. They had a 10-minute speaker just like this one. Then they took a break. And during the break, everybody got up. And you know how I do at breaks. I see all my people I haven't seen in a while. And we hug and we greet. And I was sitting about right there. And I wouldn't move because I was terrified. I was scared that nobody noticed me. And I was scared that everybody was looking at me. I feel you, newcomers. I didn't want to walk and get coffee because I might stumble. That's the place I was at. You guys used to say good phone numbers. With the place I came from and the people I was rolling with, when I came in in 86, I didn't have a phone and none of my friends did. And I wouldn't ask any of you for phone numbers because I didn't want to embarrass you into having to tell me you don't have a phone. So I was in a real scary place. And at the break, I was sitting by myself. And I felt like an outsider inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy came up to me at the break. And he was leading the meeting, and he asked me my name. And we resumed the meeting, and the speaker spoke. And I can't tell you who spoke or what they talked about. And at the end of the meeting that night, Bob Hunt said, after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, I want my new friend, Ralph. And somebody knew my name in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to leave a meeting knowing somebody knew his name in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started rolling with this guy. And they started asking me out on panels. And of course, I thought that somebody had heard my message at 6 months and really needed to hear, yes, I'll go, you know, and I'm going on these panels. And every time I leave one, I walk with my head a little higher, walking with a sense of purpose. I took a commitment in my home group, and I started getting there early and setting up. Then I became assistant secretary at a meeting, and I started shaking people's hands. And people started knowing me when I came in the room, new friends, walking with a sense of purpose. And I started walking with my head up a little bit higher. At 18 months of recovery, I saw a group come in. And they had shared in a way I had never seen. And I was hungry. I was hungry for this deal, man. And they were talking about this process of recovery, this outline. And they broke these steps down in a way I had never heard. And I asked this other guy, I want that. And we started meetings in my mom's house, in a little house, 8 people, sitting around my mom's dining room table, breaking that book open, going from the cover page all the way through the end, walking with a sense of purpose. At about 2 years sober, a guy saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and he asked me to sponsor him. That guy is 19 years sober now, and we've been trudging, walking with a sense of purpose. And it's men and women in this room and rooms like this that grew up a guy like me, that gave me more than I came in here for. That's not why I came. The things we do in these rooms, man, this ain't about things on these, you know, this ain't about the things on the easel. If you think this program is just about not drinking and just about not using, if you think it's about learning these steps, you're shortchanging the program and you're shortchanging yourself. This program is about a whole lot more than that. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that can do anything but fail. What this program is really about, put a face on the program, Alcoholics Anonymous. It ain't about just this and this. Me and Bob were talking about the things that go. You know, the program Alcoholics Anonymous is people. I have a friend up in Canada, Lou Finneman, and Lou says the program Alcoholics Anonymous, this fellowship walks, talks, and shakes hands. It's living. It's alive. It's vital. It does stuff for me. If you want to know what the program Alcoholics Anonymous is about, you take a look around this room right now. Put a face on Alcoholics Anonymous. What this program is really about is about taking people like us, drunks and boosters and convicts and con artists, strawberries and tricks and hustlers, child abusers, wife abusers, failures as parents, failures as kids, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. This program takes people like us and puts us together in one room, and I stick one hand in your hand, another hand in God's hand, and we pick up our beds and we walk out of these rooms as mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, employees, employers, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If it's going to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. Firm believer in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Firm believer in the process of recovery that's contained in those steps. Firm believer in this triangle that it is that we do. I was listening to Louie when he was talking about, and it reminded me of a song. Some of you guys may not know Al Green. How do you mend a broken heart? Thank you, Louie. But Louie was talking about how do you mend a broken heart? And somebody in here might feel like they're in a real dark place. How do you get out of a deep, dark hole like that? How do you put something back together? And there's a line in our book. And see, I talk about the big book Alcoholics Anonymous because mostly everything I know about recovery comes from there. My very life as an ex-problem drinker depends on my constant thought of others and how I can meet your needs. When I most think I need you to come see about me, that's when I need to come see about you. A lot of paradoxes in this program, man, but I'll let you know, as some people in here to know the secret. If you come from a dark place, if you come from a low place, if you come from a place where don't nobody want to see you coming, if you come from a place where you still feel unnecessary sober, if you come from a place where you just want to lay down and pull the covers up over your head sometime, if life gets too big for you like it gets too big for me every now and then, you know, I've learned some things. That's the secret in this program, man. We got a program of recovery, and we got a symbol in our program: unity, recovery, and service. Unity, I bring my body to the fellowship, man, and it's nothing like coming and getting with you guys, and it treats my body, you know. Recovery, I take my recovered mind to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and then I take that recovered spirit and I put it in the service. And that, you see what I'm doing tonight? I'm standing in the light. I'm standing in the spotlight. This is the spotlight of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's some people in this room that know the secret. I loved it when Kim was standing up here and she was sharing about the H and I work. Because there's some service soldiers sitting in the room right now. There's some people who know the secret. If you've never done sponsorship, if you've never seen the light come on in somebody else's eye, if you never see it's some men and women sitting in here, and they go out on a Wednesday, and they take a coffee pot, and they turn the lights on, and they don't know who's showing up, and they wait on a guy like me. It's some men and women in here that do that. It's some men and women in here that get up from their televisions and they get up from the sporting events and they take my telephone call. It's some men and women in here. It's some men and women in here that no matter what it is that's going on, and that is the secret for me. I've done a lot of things in these 21 years. I've been ass out, I've been broke. I made mistakes, I fell down. You guys are like the Verizon network. Everywhere I go, you know, alcoholism, you stood with me at my wedding. You stood with me at the birth of my kids. You stood with me when my daughter graduated from UCLA. You stand with me right now. You know, God damn, time goes so fast when you're having fun. You know, I just have to, you know, I have to give a shout. You know, I'm standing up here tonight. I got a 12-year-old daughter, you know, who's never seen her daddy loaded. One day at a time, she never will. And I put that girl on a plane for Australia this past Friday. And then when I put my 12-year-old girl on the plane for Australia, she's in a people-to-people student ambassador program, and she's gone for 20 days. And stepdaddy didn't pay. Ain't no stepdaddy. Big new uncle didn't pay. Seeing her off at the gate and paying the money. Daddy, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. My older daughter was there to see her off too. Saturday, she starts the University of San Francisco Law School. That's the little girl whose piggy bank I was going in. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I like the most about this power that allows me to do that, he ain't tired. He don't discriminate. He's still in the business of putting kids back with their mamas. He's still in the business of putting fathers back in the house. He's still in the business of putting families back together. He's still in the business of putting men and women back to get work. He's still in the business of lifting drunks up. I never say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic.